Hello, today it's Archimedes, the Greek mathematician reputed to have shouted Eureka as he leapt from his bath having discovered the principles of floating bodies. Whatever the truth of the myths surrounding the man, he was certainly one of the world's greatest mathematicians. The practical application of his work in pulleys and levers created formidable weapons such as catapults and ship tilting systems, allowing his home city in Sicily to defend itself against the Romans. "Give me a place to stand and I will move the earth," he declared. But despite these triumphs, his true love remained for maths' sake. Plutarch wrote, "He placed his whole affection and ambition in those purer speculations where there can be no reference to the vulgar needs of life." His most important breakthrough came in the field of geometry, with his work on the areas and volumes of curved objects. So how did this Greek mathematician in the 3rd century BC arrive at a calculation of pi? Did he really create a death ray to fight off invading ships? And what does a recently discovered manuscript reveal about his methods? Joining me to discuss Archimedes is Jackie Steadall, Junior Research Fellow in the History of Mathematics at Queen's College, Oxford, George Phillips, Honorary Reader in Mathematics at St Andrews University, and Serafina Cuomo, Reader in the History of Science at Imperial College, London. Jackie Steadall, what do we know about Archimedes' early life, the dates and so on?
Well, we know almost nothing at all. We know that he lived in the 3rd century BC. We know that he lived in Syracuse in Sicily. And we know when he died, and really that's about all we know about him. We do know that his father was an astronomer called Phidias. Archimedes tells us that himself in the preface to one of his treatises. So we know a little bit about his father, but nothing else about his family or his birth or upbringing.
What do we know about that city, the Greek city in Sicily, so near, obviously so near Italy, but still a Greek city with a Greek culture there?
It's a Greek city with a Greek culture. I mean, we talk about the Greeks, but Archimedes actually lived in Syracuse in Sicily, and he was part of a Greek culture that by that time had spread around the Mediterranean. So when we talk about the Greeks, we're talking about Greek-speaking or Greek-writing people who might live anywhere around the edge of the Mediterranean. And there's no evidence that Archimedes ever set foot in Greece itself. He's thought to have visited Alexandria in Egypt and lived in Syracuse, but not Greece. But he would have written in Greek.
And his education would have been in Greek.
I don't know. I don't know about that.
But we can make a fair speculation that being a Greek-speaking person who wrote in Greek, he may well have been educated at something like the Greek academies which had been in Athens.
Possibly. But possibly. We don't know.
So have you any idea what influences, though, there might have been on him? I'm not committing you to fact, Jackie, but the merest speculation.
Well, he obviously knew some mathematics. I mean, his father might have educated him to some extent, and then whatever other education he had. He was a little bit later than Euclid, may have lived even at the same time as Euclid, but we don't know whether he read Euclid himself. He certainly knew some of the propositions that do appear in Euclid, but whether he read them there or somewhere else, we don't know. So he would have known that kind of Euclidean geometry. That would have been familiar to him.
So we know he was born, his father's an astronomer. We know he lived in a Greek city-state, in Syracuse. We know that he died in battle, or he was killed in a battle.
Yes, he was killed
at the age of 75.
The age of 75 comes from much later reports that said he lived until 75, so that's not really reliable. It may be true. But we're pretty certain that he died in 212 BC during the siege of Syracuse. And there are lots of stories about that.
The thing that's interesting is that I'm one of the things, a few things I did know about Archimedes before I got to grips with this a week ago, what now seemed to be a complete encrustation of myths.
Yes,
the jumping out of the bath and running down the street crying Eureka, and so on and so forth. It's almost as if he had become a sacred person and you had to have myths to sustain his specialness.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, the trouble with these big figures is that they become mythological, and people like Pythagoras or Euclid or Archimedes attract stories around themselves which have maybe some basis in fact, but we can't really know. And it also happens that later treatises are attributed to these people because, you know, who else would you attribute it to? You think of a big name and you say he must have written it. But so we don't always know that things that are said to be written by Archimedes really were written by him.
Well, let's go through this veiled, and let's continue a little bit with Serafina Cuomo through this veiled subject of Archimedes, who did exist and was born. Jackie's going to give us that. That's okay. But it's thought he might have gone to to study in Alexandria. There seems to be records of correspondence with people in Alexandria, the great museum-university-library combination at the time, which is sort of taken over from Athens. Can you tell us about the significance of the contact he had, stroke may have had, with Alexandria?
Yeah, I think it's almost certain that he went to Alexandria. And we know for sure that he was in correspondence with people who lived in Alexandria, because he tells us so in the introductions to some of his works. For instance, one of the people he writes his works for is the chief librarian of the Library of Alexandria, who was Eratosthenes. So there is a direct contact there. Alexandria at the time was the cultural capital of the Mediterranean world. Athens was really in decline by that time. So if he wanted to go somewhere where he would have had the best education and got in touch with the most famous intellectuals, stroke scientists of the time, Alexandria was the place to go.
There's been a revision of the idea of Alexandria recently, and the Egyptians are thought to have played a much bigger part.
Yeah.
Egyptian intellectuals, and let's use that word just to keep.
Yes.
Than was previously assumed. Can you tell us about that? Because it's a much more mixed place than the great centre of Greek learning.
I think the idea of any state or country in the Mediterranean world in antiquity has been monocultural is definitely gone. So I think the recognition that Alexandria was a multicultural capital has finally come. For a long time, people were keen to say there were the Greeks on the one side and there were the Egyptians on the other side, and they didn't really mix. But the evidence tells us otherwise. So I think it's fair to say that the knowledge that he got imbibed with in Alexandria was Greco-Egyptian. It was a mixture of the two. And people from the two groups, if we want to call them that, mixed, because we have evidence that they did.
And what sort of, can you give us one or two instances of what he might have learned in Alexandria or from Alexandria, whether he went or it was through letters, whichever?
I think, and this is really speculation, that two main areas that he would have been exposed to in Alexandria that may have been of interest to him were mathematics and catapult construction, because we know that Alexandria was a huge center for both of them. Euclid, whether he was an older contemporary or a contemporary of Archimedes, is thought to have operated in Alexandria. So he would have been in touch with mathematical knowledge being practiced, collected, reflected upon. And as for catapult construction, we know from another 3rd century treatise that the kings of Alexandria were particularly keen on that and put money into research. So there would have been one place where engineers from all around the Mediterranean would converge to learn new techniques.
So from the beginning, you have very practical application of mathematics in inventions generally driven by war, and the abstract theories. What sources do we have for his life? Clearly not good enough to convince Jackie that he had anything of a life at all, but never mind. What sources do we have that the rest of us can sort of peg along with?
Apart from his own works, we have three historians. The closest to him in time is Polybius, who's a later 3rd century BC, who's a Greek historian. Then we have Livy, who's a late 1st century BC, who's a Roman historian. And then later on, Plutarch, responsible for the image of Archimedes as the genius only interested in pure maths. Mm-hmm. And this is a Greek from the late 1st century AD. I would say those are the three main ones.
And briefly, would you say they were reliable or...
Polybius, yes. I like Polybius. He was closer in time to Archimedes. And is interested in Greek-Roman relationships. That's where Archimedes' story fits in. Livy, yes, why not? Plutarch, I think, was more of a philosopher than a historian.
George Phillips, we mentioned already he's picking up or being instructed in, perhaps through Alexandria or in Alexandria, weapons of war. And he was called on, as we understand it, to help in the defence of his home city of Syracuse when the Romans attacked it. What kind of inventions came up from him in the war context?
Well, I'm not sure, again, whether Archimedes invented all the things that are attributed to him, but there are there are three described by Plutarch and others, and one is the catapult already mentioned, which is said to have had an adjustable range, and this was used chiefly against, I understand, the Roman naval forces who were besieging the city-state of Syracuse.
Is it a catapult as we understand it? Or is it a different... how can you describe this catapult? Because most people will think, you know, a Y stick with a bit of elastic and a pouch and a pebble in it and whack. It's not that
I
sort of catapult.
I frankly don't know.
Right, well, that's fair enough.
But I have been imagining, and perhaps Serafina might know more about this, I've been imagining it might be something on the lines of a giant crossbow or something of that kind. Anyway, that was one. Another thing was he had long poles that he levered out over the walls to drop giant boulders on the ships, presumably ships that were too close to use the catapult on. And then there were... Now, the third thing is seems to me perhaps rather more fanciful... his cranes that leaned out over the city walls towards the invading Roman fleet and grabbed down, and the account goes on to say, picked ships up out of the sea and shook them around like a terrier shaking a rat until the sailors fell out. And I think this is perhaps getting towards what I used to read in my early days in the Eagle comic. I should say that he was, as you said in your introduction, he was a master of various tools of the trade, like the lever and pulleys. Systems of pulleys. One remembers at school seeing a system of six pulleys where the rope goes around them in a clever way and you pull one end, and with only about 1/6 of the effort can pull something six times as heavy as the effort applied. Now, he was a master of that, one understands. Also, the lever. He was particularly addicted, one might say, to the lever. And he even used the lever in a theoretical way in his mathematics. The lever, remember, is like a bar, pivoted, and a long arm on one side, short arm on the other side. Apply the pressure, apply the force on the long arm, and with, again, rather like the pulley thing, you get what the physicists call a mechanical advantage. With a smaller force, you can move a larger weight. And the simplest example I know of this is the child's seesaw, where we're all familiar, those of us who've had children and so on, have putting the little child on the end of the seesaw, and the adult can sit on the other side of the point of balance, but nearer the point of balance. So effectively, the weight of the small child is raising a larger weight. So these things he was thoroughly acquainted with.
There's also a story of him using lenses against invading ships, a kind of death ray, lenses which caught the sun and reflected onto the ships and burnt them. So is this fanciful?
I rather think so. I rather think so.
But nevertheless, despite all this fancifulness, now we got the life out of the way, there wasn't a great deal to say about it, but such as there was, we've done. He left a great deal of mathematical papers for the time, I understand about 8 or 9, Jackie. Just to finish the devices, though, can we talk... So there's a lot to talk about in his work. The work's there. He was the man that we think he is in the intellectual development of the West. He was the great mathematician we think he is, just to restore our listeners' faith in this person. And he was... People like Galileo and Leibniz and Newton look back to him and so on and so forth. So there he still is. Can you tell us about one more invention while we're in the inventions before we turn to the mathematics, Jackie Steddle? The Archimedes screw, how useful a device was that? And if you can tell people how it worked.
Yes, the device that's called the Archimedean screw consists of something like a large corkscrew enclosed in a cylindrical casing. And you lower the bottom of it into water, and then by turning the screw, the water starts to rise up the corkscrew, rather like the principle of taking a cork out of a wine bottle. The cork rises up the screw as you turn. And it's that principle for drawing water out of a well or a reservoir or a ditch or something and getting it up and out onto your fields. So that would be the purpose and the use of this.
massively useful for irrigation, yes, especially in Mediterranean
yes,
countries.
Yes, and the story is that he invented this in Egypt, of course, but I don't know whether that's true.
Of course. Disappointed if you did. You've established yourself. Jackie the doubter. Quite right. Serafina Guerma, one of the best-known stories since discredited on this programme is that he jumped out of his bath shouting, Eureka, after he'd... it had come to him that he could work out volume in water through floating bodies. Now, can you explain? Let's forget about the Eureka and running naked down the street. It's a nice story, but maybe it's an aid memoir rather than truth. I'd rather like to think it's true, but then, oh yeah, we all have our little fantasies. What was he doing there, and how original was this discovery?
I like to think the story is true as well. What was he doing there?
It's worse for you than for me, come to think of it.
The story goes that he was there to be a detective for his king, really. He was interested in the problem because the king of Syracuse had had a crown made for him by an artisan out of gold. When the crown was ready, he thought that the artisan had kept some of the gold and put silver into the mixture, so wanted to find out whether that was true or not. It is thought, and this comes from a description in Vitruvius so much later, it is thought that Archimedes may have measured the quantity of water displaced by masses of gold and silver respectively, and then measured the quantity of water displaced by the crown and detected whether the crown was just gold or a mixture of silver and gold. But the actual procedure is still a matter for dispute.
How important was this discovery, George? And had it been, was there any precedent for it? Did he arrive at this, as it were, through his own thought, or was he picking up on things that were in the air in Alexandria or wherever else?
I really don't know what the background was. I really don't know. It's, the details, as Serafina said, are doubtful. But the interesting thing is how he applied his mind to practical problems. It seems to me he was really a servant of in a sense of the king of the city state of Syracuse, King Hiero, and some say he was indeed a relative of his, and the king was very impressed with all Archimedes did, and I think Archimedes plugged this, and he made sure the king knew about it. A colleague of mine said it's almost as if he was applying for a research grant. It's a dreadful thought. But, he was certainly aware of the notion of density, one assumes, there, of course, to that the idea that he could immerse the one theory is that how he solved Hiero's problem was that he immersed the crown in a full vessel of water, perhaps with a tray underneath to catch the water displaced, and so he could then find the amount of water displaced, therefore the volume of the crown, and knowing the volume and weighing it, he would know the density. And since it would be less, presumably, according to the story, than the density of gold, then it couldn't be all gold.
Jackie Settle, why was this so important? Why has it proved to be so important, this work on floating bodies?
Well, the principles that Archimedes discovered are still correct principles and still taught in schools today, indeed. One of the things, as George described, is that this principle of displacement of water enables you to calculate the volume of something and therefore its density. And the other is that you have to know, if you want to float ships, you need to know something about what weight the ship can be, what shape it can be, what displacement. It's the displacement of water that the ship makes that gives it the upthrust and allows it to float. So these calculations are the kinds of calculations that he was interested in.
But ships had been floating before he made these calculations.
Well, people would know from experience which boats floated and which didn't. But if you want to do calculations, you need the principles that Archimedes was working on.
Serafina,
I wanted to mention that Galileo Galilei was inspired by the episode of the crown and Archimedes to write a short treatise on hydrodynamics. performing pretty much the same experiment, but in a different way. So what he did with the crown was one of the inspirations, if you like, for part of the so-called scientific revolution.
Right, 1700 years later.
Well, I'm still doing such experiments in school, and presumably they still are taught in schools.
Can you tell us how he approached the problem of calculating pi and why it was such a tantalising objective?
Yes, this was one of the big problems that Greek mathematicians were interested in, the calculation of pi, or to put it another way, finding the area of a circle, which involves the calculation of
pi. Now, here we're talking about, sorry to interrupt, because I really wanted you to go on, I just want to make a distinction. Here we're talking much more about pure mathematics.
Yes, we are.
When you're getting catapults that George has talked about, or weighing whether the crown is gold or silver, it's great mathematics, but it's practical.
Yes.
This is just an interesting problem.
This is what we would now call pure mathematics.
Yes.
It's a purely mathematical problem. And the problem is, we would say nowadays, to find the area of the circle. And as I say, this involves pi, and this is a very difficult thing to do. And in fact, finding an exact value of pi, we now know, is impossible. So it's not surprising that they had to try so hard to find it and that it was so difficult. Archimedes' approach to this was to take a circle and inscribe it with a polygon, an eight-sided figure, for example. And then by gradually increasing the number of sides, you get closer and closer to the circle. And so he could calculate, and you can also fit a polygon outside your circle, which gives you an upper bound, and again, keep dividing the number of sides and get closer and closer. And doing this, he found a value of pi that's between 3 and 1 seventh and 3 and 10 71sts. Which is very close. 3 and 1 seventh is 22 over 7, which is the approximation that we still use, or still did use before calculators in the 20th century. It's very close, and it's actually the closest approximation you can get in reasonably small numbers.
So he worked out, if you put it, he had a 96-sided...
He had a 96-sided polygon.
Inside and outside
inside
the circle, and
outside,
could measure these
right.
straight lines.
You can measure the straight lines very easily.
And so he calculated...
Or at least you can calculate the straight lines. Yeah. He wasn't interested in measuring them. He was interested in an exact calculation, but he could do that.
Sorry, George, you want to come in?
Yes, just to add to the story, he began, one understands, with triangles, just which of course give very, very crude approximations. Triangle inside the circle and triangle touching outside the circle. And then he had a formula for calculating the perimeter of a polygon with double the number of sides of the previous one. So he went from 3 to 6 to 12 to 24 to 48, thank you God, to 96 that you mentioned. And so that's how he did it. And he had terrific control over his arithmetic. He was a wizard of arithmetic. So that, as Jackie says, he always kept sure bounds. He knew that his number was not below this or above that. He knew it was always within these bounds. And even beginning with the triangle, he had to have an accurate number to start with. So he found very good approximations to the square root of 3.
Okay. And remember, he's doing all this with a relatively crude method of writing down numbers. He doesn't have our nice decimal number system. He has an alphabetic system for writing numbers. So alpha is 1, beta is 2, gamma is 3, and so on. It's even less useful in a way than the Roman number system. So actually doing calculations in that system is quite remarkable.
Sorry for interrupting. Would this have been put to any practical use? Would it have been recognised? Was it accepted into mathematical lore from then on?
I would say yes. As for the actual applications of that, as you said, there were floating ships before he discovered hydrodynamics, and people did things before he discovered pi. So I think it's a matter more of educated architects maybe wanting to do their things more precisely, or educated engineers wanting to do their things more precisely and possibly using this. We have evidence from a commentary on Archimedes by someone who wrote in the 6th century AD, so much later, saying that what he did with the circle was known to be useful for all purposes in life. And that's as good as it gets in terms of evidence.
Can we talk about calculating the area of a circle, Jackie Studdall? We're still in pure mathematics, aren't we? That drew him to that. So the idea of him, which you describe in one of the one of the authorities that you don't think a great deal of, is being because we have these mathematical papers from him, so we have the real stuff, the centre stuff. So we must keep firm on that. That has come down to us almost miraculously through Arab translations and so on and so forth. So these are they're intact and they are there. So tell us about what interested him in calculating the area of a circle and why it was so difficult.
Why it's so difficult, as I've said, is that we can't find an exact value for pi. What he was trying to do is something that's impossible. I mean, we now know that. I'm using the word pi here. Pi is a much later description of this number. It's the ratio of the diameter of a circle to the circumference to the diameter, sorry. What he was able to do was find an equivalent area to the circle. He was able to find a triangle that is exactly equivalent to the circle, and this is a very interesting construction.
How do you do that?
He does. Well, if you imagine a bicycle wheel, say, with paint on its rim, and you roll it along the ground for exactly one turn, so you have a line on the ground that's exactly the circumference of the bicycle wheel, and then you were to erect a post at one end of the line, which is the radius of the wheel, so it would be the distance from the bottom of the wheel to the hub. And then you join the top of your post to the other end of the line. I'm drawing this on the table. I hope the listeners can understand it. The area of that triangle is exactly the same as the area of the circle. Exactly.
And this is calculated, though.
You can't calculate it, but geometrically you can prove that these are the same area.
And that's what he did.
And that's what he did. And it's a very interesting comparison, and it's a very interesting proof that he gives that these are identical. And this isn't to do with calculation, because you can't calculate either of them exactly, but you can prove that they're exactly equal.
So if it's not to do with calculation, and they didn't have bicycles, so he did it with something else, it is to do with... Are we talking about pure thought, abstract thought?
Yes, pure abstract thought. And the way he proved that these two areas are equal is that, first of all, you suppose that the circle is a little bit greater than the triangle, and then he proves that that leads to a contradiction, that can't be true. And then you suppose that the circle is a little bit less than the triangle, and that too leads to a contradiction. This is a double contradiction. The only option left to you is that the circle and the triangle are identical.
That seems to have been one of his methods throughout,
and
doesn't
it? He was a master of this method, yes. It's a method of double contradiction, which he used a lot and was extremely adept with it. And it's a very solid method of proof. It's a method that mathematicians still use, proof by contradiction, because you
can't... So it's not that, and it's not that, so it's bound to be the other.
You can't allow contradictions into mathematics, so as soon as you have a contradiction, your hypothesis has to go.
Can we talk about George Hertz? Can we talk about his findings in volume, the sphere inside the cylinder, for example?
Oh, yes. This is what Archimedes seems to have regarded as his greatest achievement. He wished to estimate the volume of a sphere. And how he did it was he imagined cutting the sphere into two equal bits. So we've got two hemispheres. Take one of the hemispheres and put the flat side down on the table. So you've got this little mound, this hemisphere. And round about the hemisphere, you imagine a cylinder that fits tightly around the hemisphere and has the same height as the hemisphere. Now, he had a good look at that, and he had a very, very clever argument. And he did this by imagining slicing through this configuration. That's to say, hemisphere surrounded by a cylinder. And he showed that the... Of course, what the slice...
So he's imagining slicing.
He's imagining slicing through. And the slice would have an inner circle, typically part of the hemisphere, and the outer circle, which is fixed, of course, the constant height, the constant width of the cylinder. Now, the clever bit was he subtracted the little circle from the big circle, as it were. That gives you what we call an annulus, a ring. And he demonstrated that the area of that was exactly the same as the area of a slice of a cone. Now, he's not content with having a hemisphere, a cylinder. He also imagines, he can't put all these things physically in, of course, but in his imagination, he imagined a cone. Now, that would be with the flat side at the top and the point down on the table. And so, therefore, he was able to calculate the the volume of the hemisphere by summing up all these slices, because it was the difference between the volume of the cylinder and the volume of the cone. Now, the volume of the cone was already known. It was known to be one-third of the area of its base times its height. And so Archimedes deduced that the volume of the hemisphere was two-thirds the volume of the what's called the circumscribing cylinder, his great triumph. Game solved.
Brilliant. I even understood that. Right, Serafina Quirma, he also did something, as I'm told, unusual, very unusual at the time, work with huge numbers, considering the universe. Can you explain the sand reckoner question, which, as I understand it, is slightly out of line with most of what he did. It stands on its own as one of his experiments. The sand reckoner problem. Over to you, Serafina.
Yes, Jackie was saying right now that Greek numbers were quite difficult to manipulate. One other limitation of the Greek numerical system was that you couldn't express really big numbers, because at some points you ran out of letters of the alphabet. So the sand reckoner is a kind of display piece that combines a new arithmetical system and astronomy. And it's interesting that it was a display piece, because unlike the other treatises, it's not addressed to a mathematician, but to the prince of Syracuse, the co-regent of Hierogelon. So it was more letter to the prince to show him how good Archimedes was. The idea is that Archimedes is going to count the number of grains of sand that the whole universe can contain, which is, I think, in modern terms, 10 to the 58th power. Thanks, Jackie. So in order to do that, first he has to measure how big the universe is, and he takes an ideal number. He doesn't think this is really how big the universe is. He takes the biggest number possible. And then he has to fill it up with grains of sand. And in order to do that, he has to devise a whole new numerical system that allows him to express such big numbers.
And how does he devise this numerical system, Jackie?
Well, he begins with something that he calls a myriad, which in modern terms is one with eight zeros after it, so 100 million.
No, four zeros for the myriad.
Four zeros for the myriad. Okay, so eight zeros is
a
myriad.
I'm so pleased to see this is going on between the three of you. It makes me feel just a tiny bit smug.
Well, when you've counted up to a myriad, then your next unit is a myriad myriads.
Yeah.
And then a myriad myriad myriads. So it's similar to what we have now. You might have 1,000 and then 1,000,000 and 1,000,000,000, but the myriad is four zeros instead of three.
But it is entirely imagined, isn't it, this? Because he can't do it with the Greek numbers, and there's nothing for him to play with. And try to fill the universe with grains of sand, apart from sounding like a poem by William Blake, he makes this... Is this a theoretical possibility, even? The way he demonstrates it?
I'm sorry, what?
Does he make it seem even a theoretical possibility, the way he demonstrated in his theory of the sand reckoner?
Oh, he demonstrates that he's capable of handling numbers of any magnitude, any magnitude at all, because he starts off with this myriad times myriad as kind of one giant unit, and then he then uses numbers, in a sense, to describe what happens next, because... The myriad myriad is like one unit of a new kind of big super number. I mean, just as 100 is a super number compared with 1 and 1,000 and so on. But he just keeps piling on what we would think now is just adding 8 zeros at a time in our decimal system.
It is often said that the Greeks were scared of infinity, but Archimedes wasn't scared of infinity at all. Not of big numbers, not of playing with the infinitesimals, as the palimpsest probably demonstrates.
Yes. Can we just, before we talk about his legacy, find out if there's any consensus among you about how he died? Serafina, I think I'll give it to you, because you seem most willing to play in this field.
Polybius was my favorite historian here. Unfortunately, he doesn't have a report of his death, because the book becomes fragmentary at this point. So the earliest report is Livy. I think we can all agree that the Roman general who took Syracuse after 2 years of siege didn't want Archimedes to be killed. It was too valuable a resource. So that's, I guess, right. Consensus. Yeah. Then how did he die? Probably killed by a soldier, probably unintentionally. What was he doing when he died? That's a big problem, because according to some sources, and with I think it's Plutarch. Plutarch reports more than one version. He was too engaged in proving one of his geometrical propositions to even care that Syracuse was being taken and that the soldier was about to kill him. Hence the now famous phrase, leave me alone or leave my circles alone. and the soldier, being a Roman soldier, just went and killed him. Yeah. But there is an alternative story according to which Archimedes was trying to make himself known to the Roman general and transporting all his astronomical and mathematical instruments with him. And he got killed by a soldier, but this time because the soldier mistook the scientific instruments for gold and so was trying of getting them.
George Phillips, how was he regarded during his lifetime in the, say, 100 years that followed?
Well, I think that he, my colleagues here, being historians, which I am really not, will tell us better. But I understand that his reputation went a bit cold after in the immediate period after he died, okay. Did it not?
Yes, I think his work wasn't particularly taken up immediately after his lifetime, as far as we know. But his works were translated first into Arabic. This is quite a little bit later, not 100 years later, but 400 or 500 years later. His works were translated and preserved, both in Greek manuscripts and Arabic manuscripts.
But it was very, Cicero is very proud of the fact of finding Archimedes' tomb, isn't he? When
that's
he becomes
true.
Governor,
yes,
of governor, whatever
yes.
it's called, governor general of Syracuse. And this is a great thing that Cicero brings to the world. He has found the tomb, which has been neglected and overgrown and so on, but it proves what an educated, indeed, my goodness, man he was. And so we're talking about somebody who resonates with a great thinker following on quite quickly from that. But the Arabic translations, and then the work is translated from Arabic into Latin, and then we got the Greek coming from Constantinople. So by the time we're getting into the Renaissance, by the time of Galileo, the work is coming through. Do you want to develop that, Serafina?
The work is definitely coming through. I think the key point of interest for people in the scientific revolution was that in modern terms, Archimedes had been able to apply mathematics to physics, and that's what they wanted to do. That's definitely one of the main reasons why Galilei is interested in him. I mentioned a little work on the hydrostatic balance, but the main work by Galilei where he mentions Archimedes and is really influenced by him is the Two New Sciences, which are application of mathematics to physics. And at some point, Galilei says he's justified in doing that because he is protected under the wings of the great Archimedes. So he provided both a way of doing it and, if you like, a justification for doing it, because being ancient, he also was prestigious, so constituted a prestigious precedent.
Jackie?
He was also of interest to people working in what we might now call pure mathematics. I mean, his results on areas and volumes were of very great interest to later mathematicians. And one of the problems with Archimedes is that he sometimes gave results without saying how he'd got them. And he'd prove them by contradiction, but that doesn't actually tell you how he got those results. And mathematicians in the Renaissance and 17th century often criticised Archimedes for not saying how he got his results, and they put a huge amount of effort into trying to reconstruct his methods or try to work out other ways of getting to the same results. So he was actually the impetus for a lot of new research because he hadn't told everything that they wanted to know.
George Phillips, recently discovered documents causing great excitement, the Archimedes palimpsest. Can you tell us why that's so exciting?
Well, this goes back to it goes back as long as you like, but one hinge date is 1906. A professor of classics, Professor Heiberg from Copenhagen University, was in Constantinople, as it then was, and he was examining a palimpsest. Now, shall I say what I believe a palimpsest is?
You better be quick, though, because that's fine. Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's on vellum, and it's very valuable. And so these things were reused, and when a document in a vellum was no longer of interest, rather than toss it out, they would scrape off the existing message and use it again. Now, the document found by Heiberg was a prayer book written in the 13th century, and it had been used for many centuries, waxed.
So why is it important for Archimedes studies?
It was important because when they recovered this document, they found that seven of Archimedes' treatises were written there, hidden away, through various techniques, imaging techniques. They have now managed, and this is since 1998, when this document was sold off at auction, and they have recovered. It contained the only copy of The Method, which was a famous.
What was that, Jackie? What was The Method? Finally?
Well, the Method is the treatise in which he describes what George described earlier, how he actually found some of these results. This is what the 17th century mathematicians criticised him for, not giving his method. And in the palimpsest, there is his method. And it's a kind of balancing method that he uses, which is very close to what later mathematicians started to do and led up to the calculus.
Well, we got to the calculus. Thank you very much, Jackie Sodor, Serafina Cuomo, and George Phillips, for getting us so close to Archimedes. And next week, it's Genghis Khan, the founder of the Mongol Empire. Thank you for listening.